Betwixt the Veil, Episode 1, written by Seth Wordsmith, narrated by Aaron Miller, edited by Alex Wankier. Serendipitously, I stood with a man that was snarky, sarcastic, cynical, and a Satanist. He also happened to be very sagacious and mostly faceless. Slowly, he leaned forward and said softly to me,
"Hey, the son of Satan sold me his soul for a six-sided satire that he acquired from a retired angel. The why and how of why I'm here and how I got here isn't important. Or is it?"
He looked around, almost uncertain of what he had just said. "Yet, I bet you're asking, what on the grassy knoll am I doing talking to this odd stranger, and why is this man telling me of his dealings with the son of Satan? To tell you the truth, it doesn't seem like a very good idea, fooling with the son of the horned one himself. But who am I to talk? I'm standing here having a conversation in a dark alley with a supposed Satanist and mostly faceless man. Well, I guess he's not faceless, but hidden within the looming shadows that cloaked him within the darkness of the night, he was seemingly faceless. Yet, I digress. The day had not started like this at all. As a matter of fact, it was a very normal Devonshire day, gray and cold. I was out walking on Vire Island trying to get my head right and preparing myself for the upcoming game of Lost Cause, which I had played for the majority of my life. Most of what I had accomplished up to that point didn't add up to much. Well, for the most part. As a matter of fact, I felt I was a squashed cockroach on the sole of a shoe waiting to be scraped off on the doorstep of failure. Yeah. That's how bad it was. I couldn't even bloody well get through the doors of failure. I linger on the edge of the threshold like a useless piece of dirt. As I walked through the crisp autumnal weather, I noticed happy couples holding hands and speaking softly of their lives together. My mood seemed to emanate from me like a dark cloud. For most of the people that approach veered suddenly from the path, as if just deciding to cross the park at the last moment. I had grown used to this, for it seemed I had a knack for repelling people. It wasn't more than a month ago that my last girlfriend had broken up with me. After collecting her things, she had commented that I was constantly brooding, lacking in drive, and apparently our lovemaking was less than desirable. Well, what is a young man supposed to do when he had no father figure to teach him about that kind of stuff? Anyways, I decided to make my way to the Watershed pub for a pint, seeing that most of my woes were often solved in this manner. I left Fire Island, crossed the bridge into Totnes, entered the pub, ordered said drink, and sat alone at an outside table to smoke a cig. For a while, I just watched the River Dart tumble by, listening to jovial people chat with their friends. I drank, smoked, and idly contemplated my role in the world. My life to this point had been anything but settled. I was born in January of 1985 during a bleak winter, just on the other side of the southern Oregon border in a small California town called Hilt. Yes, there really is a place called Hilt, and no, I don't know how it got its name, as I'd only lived there until I was 5, and I don't remember much about those years. When I was old enough, my mother told me that on my second birthday, my father had been hiking around Mount Shasta and was lost in a snowstorm. My mother never really spoke of that night, nor of the strange circumstances surrounding his disappearance. I found out later on that there were reports of ethereal lights and an odd warping sky that appeared to emanate from the area where my father had been exploring that night. Most wrote this off as ramblings of conspiracy theorists, or another one of those supposed alien sightings that apparently happened around the mountain quite often. When I was 5, my mother Laura decided she could no longer bear staying in the house where she and my father had shared so many memories. It was as if his spirit inhabited that old split-level gabled house across from the train tracks. She sold off most of our belongings, packed up our 78 Ford Bronco, and moved to Nevada City, California. There, my mother got a job working for a cleaning company that catered to wealthy upper-class families. She had no experience in the cleaning industry, but they likely hired her because she was British and had what some considered to be an air of sophistication. We had lived there for 2 years when suddenly, one morning before school, I was awoken by my mother, and in hushed tones, she told me to pack my things. Within a few hours, the Bronco was loaded, and we left behind that two-bedroom apartment and headed south without looking back. This became normal over the next several years. Every 2 years or so, my mother would unexpectedly wake me in the middle of the night or early in the morning and tell me we had to pack and leave immediately. There was never any explanation or clear understanding of why. Sometimes, when my mom thought I was not listening, she would mutter to herself, clutching my father's ring, which she wore on a silver chain that always hung from her neck. It seemed as though she was conversing with someone I could not see. When I would ask her about it, she would just tell me she was talking with her guardian spirit, smile and laugh as if it were all a joke. Yet after one such occurrence, I saw her turn around and her face turned grim, as if something weighed heavily on her soul. The years drifted by like this, moving from town to town across the U.S. Yet my mother never really seemed to be happy, and those dark moods and whispers in the night became more and more frequent. At the age of 17, my mother was in one of those moods and exploded at a Winn-Dixie cashier in Georgia, my concern rapidly mounting. She started ranting that the woman was playing tricks on her, did not give her the proper change, and that she must be a pixie. I tried calming her down, but she batted me away and continued on. Security was called and she was escorted out of the grocery store with me completely embarrassed, but mostly perturbed. She finally calmed down at the car, but was still despondent and continued to mutter to herself. At this time, I knew that she needed help, which I knew I could not afford, but I was determined to do what I could to get my mother the care she needed. That week, I turned 18. Quit school, got two jobs, switched roles with my mother, and hired a part-time caregiver with some of our savings. I worked 4 tens between both jobs and took care of my mother during my free time. Over the next few weeks, my mom descended deeper into a catatonic state. Some days, the fog would clear and she would be coherent, and other days, lost, acting erratic, and delusional. It was difficult some days, as we had no one else, but I was determined to do what I could to support us. I love my mom, and I would never allow her to end up in one of those state-funded insane asylums. As you can imagine, with all the moving around, I had never really made many friends, and neither had my mother. My father's family were all dead, and he had been an only child. Apparently, my mother's family lived in the UK, in a small village in Devon. They had apparently fallen out many years past, and Mom never really spoke of them much. Well, actually, she never spoke of them at all. It was 2 years prior to this, when living in Florida, that my mother unexpectedly received a peculiar letter in our condo's mailbox. The envelope was brilliantly ornate, with no return address, made of fine paper, and encrusted with an indigo wax seal that depicted a diamond with a star in the center. Itching with curiosity, I broke the seal and pulled out 2 airplane tickets, which I put in my back pocket, and a letter which was written on even finer paper. It was pressed with flowers and gold filigree, the script in an elegant flowing hand, and it read, "Dear Larlin Solas Elwin, we write to you in the hopes to mend bonds that in great sorrow have been broken. Your father and I know that harsh words were spoken upon your departure, and that you explicitly requested to never speak with us again. Yet we love you no matter what was said in anger, and we regret many decisions made in your last weeks with us. Your father and I are very ashamed for how we acted and only wish that you can forgive us. We also greatly desire to begin a relationship with our grandson, whom we have never met and would so love to embrace as one of our own. Please consider our request, for your father and I have spent many hours with the council trying to reconcile the issues created upon your departure. As you know, I can't write in detail in regards to these issues, but know we are doing our best to find a solution. That being said, we know with the years that have passed and the unexpected death of your husband, Irun, that the world may begin weighing heavily upon you. Lucien will soon be coming of age, and without the proper guidance and teaching, he may stumble into some unexpected issues. We have enclosed in this envelope 2 open-ended plane tickets so that you and Lucien may return to us. Please come home soon. With love, Titania and Alil Elwin. My mind was reeling with all I read, and questions filled my head. What bonds were broken, and what was this argument that my mother and grandparents had? What counsel are they talking about, and what issues did they have to reconcile? What did they mean by the world weighing heavily on my mother? Did they know about her illness? What do they mean by unexpected issues I may have? None of it seemed to make sense. It was as if I knew nothing about my mother, and in turn, I felt like I knew nothing about my own identity. As I stood there stunned, Lara returned home from work. Immediately, she saw the envelope and broken seal on the coffee table and the letter in my hand. Her face went from neutral to furious in an instant. She dropped the grocery bags on the floor, crossed the room, snatched the letter from my hand and the envelope from the table. She stormed into the kitchen and found a box of matches in the knick-knack drawer and lit a match, bringing the flame to the letter and envelope and dropped them into the sink to burn. I was so shocked by her response that I could not react in time to stop her. We both stood in silence as the paper blackened to ash and the wax seal melted away, leaving only a black mark on the stainless steel. Staring at the ash, I felt a similar black mark tarnish my mood. The silence and the air hung in the room like the staleness of a mausoleum. Without a word, Lara picked up the grocery bags and began to unload them into the kitchen. Unbeknownst to her, I still possessed the 2 plane tickets safely tucked away in my back pocket. This strange occurrence was made even stranger by the fact that Lara never spoke of it, acting as if it never happened. I tried to talk to her about it a few times over the next 2 years before she fell deeper into her psychosis, but she would just look at me as if she had no idea what I was talking about and quickly change the subject. Yet sometimes I would hear her crying in her room or quietly singing songs in a language not of this world. The mournful melody would rise and fall, aching with longing and loss, like a dirge for the dead. This was the only time in my life that I had learned anything about my mother's family. I felt lost in a void of confusion, and my heart ached with anguish. It's as if loneliness was the only thing that me and my mother now shared. Now with my constant work, I found myself in a rhythm like I was on autopilot, going from work to home and back again, living the life of that oh-so-beautiful American dream, how much we love to hate it. With me not being able to afford the caretaker for too many hours, I would have to return home promptly after every day of work. It was one of those hot, muggy summer nights, the kind you only get in Georgia. A night that feels like you're swimming in a swamp of your own sweat and your hands are as sticky as if coated in honey. That night, I returned home on the bus. Yet as I approached our 2-bedroom house at the end of a lonely cul-de-sac, I smelled smoke. It was faint at first, but as I got closer, I could see the smoke billowing out from the back bedroom where my mother slept. Instantly, I was sprinting. I ran past our Bronco, up the small flagstone path to the front door, and in one smooth movement, I turned the handle while still rushing forward and entered. It was as if I had just stepped into a war zone. In the living room to my right, all the chairs were broken and strewn amongst the overturned dining table and computer desk. The couch was shredded from arm to cushion, and just beyond the living room and the kitchen, all of the cabinets and their contents were shattered and debris lay all over the floors. There were blood stains on the carpet that led from the bedrooms to the back slider on the far side of the living room. The smell of smoke and blood were thick in the air, tinged with an undertone of sulfur and ozone, which seemed out of place. I rushed forward through the twinkling light of the broken glass and debris, turned left down the hall towards our bedrooms and in the direction of the acrid smoke. As I turned the corner, I could see that the door to my room was still closed, but the bathroom and the wall to my mother's room were shattered and smoldering, as if a pipe bomb had gone off. I rushed forward, following the bloodstains at my feet, ignoring the heat of the building fire and the choking smoke. I entered through the remains of the door frame to find the room void of my mother's presence, but filled with a scene straight out of a horror film. Blood splatters all over the white walls, dripping down into pools below, with the furniture destroyed, only splinters and shreds of cloth remaining. The sole occupant being that of Esmeralda, Lara's plump and kindly caretaker, slumped against the wall next to the crumbling closet. She had a bullet hole in her forehead and fragments of furniture and glass protruding from her body. The pattern of the debris around my feet as I stood in the doorway seemed as if the origin of the blast was where Lara's bed had been. Part of the wall and roof were missing, and a warm breeze was blowing in as smoke streamed out, the stars in the night sky visible through the jagged hole like the gaping maw of some eldritch beast. There were human silhouettes burned into the walls and pools of blood where bodies must have fallen, as well as the drag marks leading out into the hall, clear evidence of their removal. To my surprise, I was completely calm despite all that I had witnessed. It was apparent from the scene in front of me that my mother was no longer here. I needed to get out as the fire was beginning to spread through the devastated room and the acrid smoke was becoming thick and overwhelming. I quickly backtracked to my room and opened the door to find that it was completely untouched. Everything was exactly where I'd left it. This confirmed my suspicion that whoever did this to the house was here for one thing only, my mother. Yet who caused all of this destruction and death? Was my mother okay? And what did they want with her? These were questions I would have to think about later as the heat and smoke of the fire grew unbearable. From all of the years of constantly needing to pick up and leave on a whim, I always kept a go bag packed, which was stowed under my bed. It held $3,000 in cash, a few sets of clothes, a hunting knife, a basic survival kit, my passport, and the two open-ended plane tickets my grandparents had sent. I quickly exited my room just as the flames breached the doorway, ran into the living room, and quickly searched through the debris on the ground for the Bronco keys. I finally found them under a piece of the fractured desk by the backsliding door. As I stood, a glint caught my eye. It was part of my mother's necklace that held my father's family ring, which she had always worn. My father had given it to her before he left that fateful night. It was wedged into the side of the aluminum doorframe as if it had caught and broken off as she passed. As I reached over and dislodged it from the frame, another suspicious object caught my eye, stuck in the tracks of the sliding door. It was a sliver of a burnt circular patch, the kind that Velcro onto uniforms. It had what looked like a green and purple border, but from the dim light I could only pick out a B and E running vertically and horizontally. I quickly snatched it up, ran out the front door, down the little stone path, and out onto the road. Someone must have smelled the smoke or saw the fire, as I could hear sirens in the distance. I walked to the Bronco, unlocked it, opened the door, and threw my go bag into the passenger seat. After all I had seen inside, I was certain that I did not want to wait around for the police to arrive and have to answer any questions. It was also clear that my mother was no longer there and that something very strange had transpired at the end of that lonely cul-de-sac on that muggy southern night. As I drove away, I peered in the rearview mirror and watched that burning and broken home fade in the distance. Yet at that moment, I had felt as though part of me had been engulfed within those flames, leaving behind only ashes, a deep sadness, loss, and loneliness that would haunt me for years to come.